This is The Rounds Table. All right, welcome back, Rounds Table listeners. This episode is going to be all related to studies in the palliative care space. John, what do you have up for us first?
So first, we're going to talk about the default palliative care consultation for seriously ill hospitalized patients, a pragmatic cluster randomized controlled trial. This was by Courtright et al., published in JAMA in January 2024.
All right. And what was the research question here?
They wanted to determine whether ordering a palliative care consult by default for seriously ill hospitalized patients improved outcomes.
Yeah, this feels really important to me as somebody who looks after patients on the inpatient ward, many of whom I think are palliative, whether they are aware of it or not is maybe another question. But why did this catch your eye?
Yeah, lots of good reasons. So, you know, observational studies have suggested that inpatient palliative care reduces lengths of stay and improves patient-centered outcomes. And, you know, just more practically, although I think it's really important as MRP to take ownership around things like goals of care conversations, some of them are straightforward and some of them can be really challenging. And I found that involving palliative care in particular with the latter can really help allow me to focus more on the medical management of things, and palliative can really help where they excel, like symptom control and furthering some of those more challenging discussions. This study examines the hypothesis of whether a default palliative care consult for older adults admitted with non-cancer serious illness would lead to improved outcomes.
Yeah, I agree, and I have a similar sentiment. At Mount Sinai, where I predominantly work, we have just an incredible palliative care group, and it's just so helpful because they do such a great job at delivering high-quality palliative care, and it allows me to focus on, you know, the acute active medical issues, and then they drive the palliative piece. So similar sentiment to yours. Anyway, what was the study design?
So this was a randomized trial comparing usual care with a default order for palliative care consultation among adults with chronic serious illness admitted to 11 hospitals in the United States. The patient population, so these were patients aged 65 or older with pre-existing diagnoses of advanced COPD, kidney failure, or dementia. There were some criteria that were used for kind of consensus that they had a high likelihood of an unmet palliative care need. Specifically for COPD, they had to have at least 2 hospitalizations in 12 months or dependence on long-term oxygen. For kidney failure, they had to be on long-term dialysis dependence. For dementia, at least 2 admissions in the prior 12 months, or from a long-term care or presence of a feeding tube. They used the electronic record to screen all admitted patients to identify those who would meet eligibility. And then they only analyzed patients once they were admitted for at least 72 hours, as they thought that the intervention was unlikely to affect patients who would be discharged sooner. During the intervention phase, palliative care consults were automatically triggered. The MRP received a notification and they did have the option to cancel, but they had to indicate a specific reason why they did not think a default order was appropriate. And then comparator was just usual care. During the study, clinicians could then consult the palliative care team at any time, though. Now, when it came to outcomes, the primary outcome was a measure of hospital length of stay. The secondary outcomes, there were a bunch. So things like rates of ICU mortality, in-hospital mortality, 30-day readmission rates, whether or not CPR was administered, need for mechanical ventilation, whether goals of care were changed at discharge, and rates of discharge to hospice. They also looked at the proportion of patients who, of course, received a palliative care consult, and this was defined as a signed palliative care note, as well as rates of consult completion and cancellation. There was a secondary analysis that utilized something called the Complier Average Treatment Effect, or CATE, which I didn't understand. It wasn't done for the primary analysis, so I mostly just ignored it.
Yeah, that sounds pretty reasonable. If you don't understand something, just ignore it. I'm just kidding, of course. It's a pretty nice study design there, you know, a randomized trial for older adults that probably have an unmet palliative need. The primary outcome of hospital length of stay, I don't love that, but anyway, now's not the time to get into limitations. Let's start. What did the patients look like who were included?
Yeah, so they looked at about 200,000 admissions for patients aged over 65. And after excluding those who did not meet criteria and then limiting those that were admitted for at least 72 hours, there were over 10,000 admissions in the default palliative care order set group and about 13,000 in the usual care group. So quite huge numbers. The median age was 77, about 55% were female. Majority of patients were white, and most, 82 to 88% had been admitted from home. In the two groups, about 70% of the patient population had COPD, about 30% had dementia, and about 10% had kidney failure. And at the time of enrollment, about 75%, the majority of patients were on the medical ward, as opposed to 25% in the ICU.
Okay. And what did they find? What was the impact of having a standard palliative consult ordered?
Yeah. So what they found was, in the default group, those patients were more likely to get a palliative care consult, but specifically that number was 44% versus 17% in the usual care group. The most common reason for opt-outs by MRP was, sort of a set phrase, but the phrase was no palliative care needs at this time, or indicating that, in quotes, the primary team is meeting all the patient's palliative care needs. Now, the primary outcome, ultimately, there was no difference in length of stay between the two groups. There were a lot of secondary outcomes, and there were some interesting signals to come out from this. There was a minor difference in the percentage that were discharged to hospice, a slightly higher rate in those in the intervention group compared to the usual care group. But it was statistically significant, but the percentage was like 6.8% in one group and 6.9% in another. So I'm not super excited about that per se. There was no difference in ICU mortality, in hospital death, or in the receipt of CPR. They did show that there was a higher percentage of patients in the default group who were discharged with, specifically in the intervention group who were discharged with a higher rate of DNR order. So that was 37% versus 30% in the usual care group. And the adjusted odds ratio was 1.40.
All right. So, a large, impressive randomized trial, but what were some key limitations here?
Yeah, a lot of the goals here were for kind of patient-focused outcomes, as is usually the case with palliative care. And so as you already identified, like length of stay is a really important measure from a healthcare systems perspective. And I think it does matter to the patient too. But, they didn't look at more specific patient-focused outcomes like symptom burden or like quality of life measures, which I think would have been nice, although admittedly difficult to capture. And then in the default group, only 44% of those patients actually had a palliative care consult. What was the driver of this? Well, probably a few different things, but one thing in particular is, what about the supply of consultants who are available to keep up with the demand for, 10,000 consults over, 11 hospitals? But that's a big ask from a healthcare resources perspective as well. They did it purposefully, but they did not include other common comorbid patient populations like patients with cirrhosis, who I think have certainly another burden of unmet palliative care needs, heart failure as well. Although admittedly, there's been a lot more focus on heart failure for kind of a palliative care needs and co-management.
Yeah. Look, this is incredible that they pulled off this randomized trial. Total kudos to them. But the primary outcome of length of stay, like that just doesn't make sense to me. And this is a trial of thousands and thousands of patients. Like, there is no shortage of statistical power. I wish they chose something like quality of care, quality of life, self-reported patient quality of life. And the other aspect is when you have a randomized trial that's this large, you can find secondary outcomes which are clinically meaningless, but statistically significant. For example, like what you mentioned, the discharge to hospice of 6.9% versus 6.8%. That difference is clinically meaningless, but statistically, it's significant because you have a massive sample size. Anyway, what's the take-home point?
Yeah, totally agree with those comments. Really, the take-home point here is that a default order for palliative care consultation did not lead to shorter length of stay among patients with advanced COPD, renal failure, or dementia.
And is this practice changing for you?
No, it's not. It is great to see a large randomized controlled trial within the realm of palliative care, but this doesn't change what I do. I think it still just emphasizes to me that, similar to your sentiment about the quality of your palliative care team, at the Foothills, we're really lucky. And so I certainly lean on my palliative care colleagues in situations of difficult goals of care conversations, in situations of like difficult symptom control as well, because all of those things can really make a big, important improvement in my patient's experience in the hospital.
Yeah, plus one on all that. I will continue to consult palliative care, that's for sure. I won't consult them on everyone, but I think this is an example of impressive study, a quote-unquote negative study, but not one that's going to change my practice. Anyway, we will change gears, but we'll stay in the palliative realm. The study I'll capture is duration of CPR and outcomes for adults with in-hospital cardiac arrest, a retrospective cohort study published in the BMJ in February 2024.
Great. What was the question here?
Following in-hospital cardiac arrest, how does the duration of CPR relate to favorable outcomes, including mortality?
That's very interesting. Why did you think this was important?
Well, to be honest, I didn't. I want us to just do randomized trials, but you told me that we should be capturing this one. So yeah, this was mainly a John Fralick reason to cover it. Alas, you know, every day I'm on service, I have goals of care conversations. I'm not sure how well those conversations are informed by data, in particular when we talk about recovery post-CPR. So still, this isn't a randomized trial, but it is important.
Absolutely. And sure, I might have pushed a little bit for this one. I mean, I think you're right. Sometimes I speak in more general terms around what I think the likely outcomes are. And so if this can help inform more data-driven discussion, that could be really interesting. All right, what was the design here?
Yeah, and to that point, you know, maybe it could also prompt a future randomized trial of, you know, stopping CPR at time point X versus continuing as per whatever the team is doing. Anyway, this current study was a retrospective cohort using data from a multi-center in-hospital cardiac arrest registry in the United States. The population, adults with in-hospital cardiac arrest between 2000 and 2021, they excluded adults that were on ECMO prior to CPR, or if they had missing data on the time of CPR, or if there was a DNR order before CPR, or if there was ECMO after CPR. I think all those are quite reasonable. You know, from an ECMO standpoint, it's a tiny, tiny slice of the population that gets that, so might as well remove those. The exposure was duration of CPR, and the outcome here was survival to hospital discharge and favorable functional outcome at hospital discharge. The way they categorized this was using something called the cerebral performance category. I had never heard of it until I read the study, but it's a 5-point scale. So a CPC score of 1 represents good cerebral performance. 5 represents brain death.
Okay. What did the patient population look like?
There were 400,000 cardiac arrests. After applying the exclusion criteria, there were 350,000. The median age was 67, 58% were men, 68% were white, and 22% were black. In terms of their sort of comorbid disease, 14% had a prior myocardial infarction, 20% had prior heart failure, 10% had cancer, and 90% of the admissions were medical. And within that, it was almost like a split, but more medical than there was cardiac, but lots of cardiac patients here. In terms of the features of the arrest, 77% had asystole or PEA, 50% occurred in the ICU or CCU, 7% occurred in the OR, and 85% of the arrests were witnessed.
Okay, what were the main results?
So the main results here, 67% of patients achieved ROSC, return of spontaneous circulation, and overall, 22% survived a hospital discharge. So, you know, said simply, 1 in 5 who had a cardiac arrest, they survived a hospital discharge. The median time between CPR and ROSC was 7 minutes among patients with ROSC. The median time interval between start of chest compressions and termination of resuscitation was 20 minutes, with an interquartile range of 14 to 30 minutes among those who did not have return of spontaneous circulation. A few more details for the outcomes. So 15% of all those with a cardiac arrest had a favorable functional outcome. And as mentioned, 22% survived until hospital discharge of all those with a cardiac arrest. For the individuals that had CPR for more than 30 minutes, there was less than 1% probability of favorable functional outcome. And the factors associated with better patient outcomes were age less than 60, a witnessed arrest, and an initial shockable rhythm.
Okay. What were some of the limitations here?
So I think the biggest limitation is external generalizability. Like, I guess what I'm most interested in selfishly is the typical GIM patient, because that's where I spend my time. This was weighted much more heavily towards like a cardiac patient. So I'm not sure how well that 1 in 5 result will really apply to the typical GIM patient. Of course, this is a retrospective study, so it has all of the usual issues with confounders and biases, but still a pretty impressive study.
Yeah, that's really fair, especially that measure of like, what, 50% of the arrests happening in the ICU or CCU. Like, those are very different clinical environments than on the general ward, where the patient may only be getting assessed every 4 hours, depending on like vitals and nursing care requirements. And so not unexpected that they would probably have worse outcomes if most of those patients were actually the unwitnessed arrests.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Yeah. So all that said, what's your take home point here?
If you're still doing CPR after 30 minutes, now is probably the time to stop. And I've certainly been part of codes that have gone past the 30-minute mark. And that's usually, sometimes sooner, when somebody sort of puts their hand up and says, hey, what are we doing here? And these data from this study certainly supports that.
Yeah, absolutely. Will it change your practice?
I don't think it will change my practice. And I was sort of hoping to walk away with a nice statistic that I could share with my GIM patients. I'm not sure if this study gives it, but I think more generally, the idea that 1 in 5 patients will survive a cardiac arrest in hospital, but maybe, I don't know, like 1 in 8 will have a good functional outcome. I think that's still useful, but no, this will not change my practice.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, John, so that's it for palliative care. Let's switch from the bad stuff to the good stuff. Before we do, this episode, similar to recent episodes, has been brought to you by the good people of Sault Ste. Marie, specifically Sault Ste. Marie Physician Recruitment and Retention. There's lots of job opportunities in the Sioux medical, surgical, psychiatric, OB, you name it, and also electives for senior residents. John, are you in?
Yeah, you know what? You love the Sioux, and I'm sure I would love it too. But hey, I'm in Calgary. It's a little farther for me, but I will promote it to any of our fellows, people looking for electives and stuff. It seems like a great opportunity.
Awesome. Okay, that's good enough for me. Anyway, what was the good stuff that caught your eye?
So the Professional Women's Hockey League, it had its inaugural season this year, and they just had this amazing record-breaking crowd show up to Scotiabank Arena for the Toronto versus Montreal game. It was over 19,000 fans. And Toronto won too, so not that bad.
Oh, that's great to see. Yeah, I've been catching the highlights recently, and it's really nice to see that. And hopefully the league is a success. For me, it's just a really funny video from YouTube by Tim Robinson from I Think You Should Leave. It's called You Expect Me to Believe That. And essentially, it's a scientist talking about global warming. And his response is essentially like, I just want to punch you because I don't understand what you're saying and it makes me angry. It's his usual shtick, but it is so freaking funny. And I guess also does some good to raise awareness of global warming.
Oh my goodness. He is hilarious. Like, listeners, if you don't already know, I Think You Should Leave, or Tim Robinson in general, check it out. Like, you know, some of it is maybe doesn't punch quite as well as the as others, but my goodness, like laughing out loud is a very common experience when I watch that show.
I totally agree. Anyway, John, stay warm in Calgary and we'll chat again soon.
Talk to you later, Mike.
The Rounds Table is hosted online at healthydebate.ca. Follow us on Twitter at Rounds Table. Thanks to our audio editors, Emilio Garcia Flores and Arjun Sharma. Also thanks to Amol Verma, founder of The Rounds Table, and Kieran Quinn, the previous director. We'd also like to give a big thanks to Seema Marwaha, editor-in-chief at Healthy Debate, for all the support.